Section 1.1, Introduction. Thought experiments have long been a staple of moral philosophy, actually of philosophy, from Plato's cave to Descartes' evil demon to Parfit's repugnant conclusion. Often it is key examples that do the heavy lifting in convincing people to accept a position. One example that has had a major impact is Peter Singer's famous pond example. Arguably, the philosophical roots of the effective altruism movement can be traced back to that example. In these talks, I will raise a number of worries about Singer's example, many of which are relevant to the practical recommendations of effective altruism. I shall present my own examples and arguments in support of these worries, but I readily acknowledge that I am not the first to express many of them. In particular, my thinking on this topic has been heavily influenced by Deaton, the 2015 Nobel laureate in economics. Before proceeding, let me confess to a certain trepidation regarding these talks. I have long thought that those of us who can ought to do much more than we normally do on behalf of the needy. Accordingly, the last thing I want to do is aid the forces of parochialism, selfishness, apathy, and skeptical resignation that dominate much of the world when it comes to the matter of aiding the needy. Still, philosophers have an obligation to pursue the arguments wherever they lead. If I learned nothing else from Derek, I learned that. And to not be blinded by their practical or ideological commitments. And unfortunately, I believe that too many well-intentioned philosophers, including me for most of my life, have been much too quick to dismiss without argument the worries that have been raised about efforts to aid the world's needy. Such reactions are unwarranted philosophically. They may also be tragically mistaken practically. This is, I believe, a possibility that must be taken seriously. My aim in these lectures is not to prove that my worries are compelling. Indeed, it would please me greatly if someone could ultimately lay them to rest. However, if that can't be done, then I and others may need to substantially revise our views regarding our obligations to the needy. An outline of today's talk is on the handout. One last word before beginning. As you know, this is the first of three lectures, and to a large extent, the first lecture just sets the stage for the following two. It is in those lectures where the real fireworks begin and some of the most difficult philosophical problems arise. So you might want to come back, even if you find this one kind of disappointing. Section 1.2, effective altruism. Effective altruism is a somewhat amorphous philosophical and social movement which seeks to promote certain morally desirable goals as efficiently as possible. In doing this, most effective altruists appeal to expected utility theory, which holds roughly that for any goal that one is pursuing, one should choose among one's options so as to maximize the expected value of one's choice in terms of the realization of that goal. Some effective altruists focus their attention on aiding non-human animals, others on existential risks, and others on promoting the effective altruism movement itself. Still others focus on aiding the world's needy. In these talks, I will be concerned with that portion of the effective altruism movement that focuses on aiding the needy. While there's room for disagreement, let me note some of the key positions commonly associated with this movement. One. Affluent people have a duty, a positive duty, to help the world's needy, typically understood as those people in the world's poorest countries facing premature death or severely debilitating conditions as a result of poverty, famine, war, tyranny, ignorance, or disease. Henceforth, in these talks, when I talk about the needy, it will be such people that I have in mind, unless noted otherwise. Two. Although many organizations do worthwhile work, not all are equally important and efficient. Nor are all ways of supporting organizations equally efficient. Accordingly, insofar as one chooses to support organizations with the aim of doing good, one should support the most efficient organizations doing the most important work. And one should do this in the most efficient manner possible. Moreover, this is so even if one believes that aiding the needy is a matter of charity and not a duty. Three, One needs criteria for determining the most effective organizations doing the most important work. Roughly, the criteria will need to take account of quality, quantity, and cost. That is, what kinds of improvements are being made, how many people are affected, and how many resources are required for an organization to produce the results that it does. Perhaps the most common approach for effective altruists is to rank aid organizations in terms of how many dollies, disability-adjusted life years, they prevent per dollar contributed to the organization. This approach, which focuses on health improvements, might best be called minimized dollies effective altruism, wherever I shall continue to simply refer to it as effective altruism for short. So far as possible, one should seek empirical evidence regarding which organizations are best. Those deemed best on the basis of empirical evidence are then listed on effective altruism websites such as givewell.org, thelifeyoucansave.org, or givingwhatwecan.org. 5. Although countless charities promote valuable causes, effective altruists believe that the best charities, understood as the most effective charities doing the most important work, are certain of the International Relief and Development Agencies. These charities supposedly give the most bang for the buck for one's contributions in terms of doing the most good by minimizing dollies. For brevity, I will typically refer to all International Relief and Development Organizations or charities, charities, agencies, etc., simply as aid groups. No doubt some effective altruists would frame their positions in different or more nuanced ways than I've done so here, but I believe that for the purposes of these lectures, I've offered a sufficiently fair and accurate characterization of most effective altruists whose primary focus is on aiding the world's needy. Section 1.3, autobiographical remarks and a summary of my views regarding the needy. There's a rich tradition in philosophy which holds that if one wants to know the truth about a given matter, one needs to adopt a disinterested, impartial perspective. If that's so, then I must confess that I am not well placed to discern the truth about our obligations to the needy. This is because for as long as I can remember, I've been touched by the plight of the needy and felt the need to do something about it. As a young boy, I was raised to be a member of the Clean Plates Club because my parents firmly believed, as I still do, that there's something deeply wrong about wasting food in a world where so many suffer from hunger. I also gave a portion of my allowance each week for the needy, happily raised money for needy children each Halloween by trick-or-treating for UNICEF, and swelled with pride when I read notes written by the teachers of African and South American children thanking my parents for providing their students with desperately needed school supplies. In 1964, my family visited New York for the World's Fair. I'll never forget the experience of coming up from the subway and seeing a young African-American woman begging for money. She was sitting on a blanket surrounded by a bevy of children, perhaps as many as 10, with a baby nursing at her breast, and a look of desperation in her eyes. I remember feeling an overwhelming sense of pity, and even more than that, an overwhelming sense of anger and shame, that hundreds of well-to-do people streamed past her, deftly avoiding her blanket, her eyes, and her outstretched hand, as if she didn't exist. Of course, as an adult, I now recognize the many reasons why giving money to a beggar on the street is problematic. Still, as a 10-year-old, that scene left an indelible mark on my psyche and helped to bring into focus in a vivid and visceral manner a set of concerns that have remained with me to this day regarding injustice, inequality, unfairness, and our obligations to the needy. In high school, I took part in a 31-mile hunger hike whose proceeds were earmarked to help alleviate world hunger and began arguing with others about the immorality of America's ethos of conspicuous consumption in a world where so many people were dying of hunger and disease. These arguments increased in 1971 as the horrors of the East Pakistan-Bangladesh civil war gripped the world's attention. Scant 3 years later, when I was a senior in college, Bangladesh once again caught the world's attention as an estimated 450,000 to 1.5 million people died between July 1974 and January 1975 as a result of starvation and diseases such as cholera and diarrhea. In graduate school, I learned about Oxfam, and I became convinced that people should devote most of their charitable contributions to effective aid groups. While there were countless charitable groups that supported causes I believed in, I came to the view that ultimately, most of those causes were less important than aiding the world's neediest members. As a professor, I helped launch a student club devoted to raising student awareness of and funds for Oxfam. This club sponsored a Thanksgiving-related hunger banquet and a university-wide meal skip program where once a week students could swipe their meal card but not take a meal, with all proceeds going to Oxfam. I also taught the topic of obligations to the deity in my large ethics classes and began collecting voluntary contributions, believe me, genuinely voluntary contributions on behalf of the needy, which over the years have summed to more than six figures. 1998, I was asked to debate the topic of obligations to the deity with Jan Narveson for the Institute on World Affairs. That led to several publications on the topic, lectures to a wide range of audiences, and my helping to launch, along with Peter Singer and Jeffrey Sachs, several chapters of the charitable organization, Giving What We Can. Among the key claims I have argued for regarding our obligations to the needy are the following. One, we should think about our relations to the needy pluralistically. In particular, I claim that the fully moral life requires that we pay attention to each of these concerns, to what happens, whether as a result of what we do or fail to do, to the kind of person we are, whether virtuous or vicious, and to our deontological duties to ourselves and others. Thus, I argue there are consequentialist-based, virtue-based, and deontological-based reasons to aid the needy. Two, regarding consequentialist-based reasons, surely an outcome in which affluent people eat out less and have fewer toys, clothes, or appliances is better than one in which many innocent people painfully die of easily avoidable causes. Three, regarding virtue-based reasons, among the most central virtues are beneficence, sympathy, compassion, and generosity. But then surely at some point, the truly virtuous person must give priority to the easily preventable hunger, illness, and suffering of others over further acquisition of goods that one does not need, may hardly use, and would not miss if one didn't have. Regarding deontological-based reasons, I argue that even if we do not violate anyone's rights or act unjustly if we fail to aid the needy, our duties extend significantly beyond merely respecting rights, and that some acts can be deeply wrong even if they are not unjust. I further argue that we have a positive duty to aid the needy that can be even stronger than many negative duties, and that will often require us to prioritize the most urgent needs. And that there could be strong reasons of justice, that is, reasons of justice, to aid the needy, even if failure to do so need not involve acting unjustly. These are technical distinctions they've argued for at length in other papers. I'm just summarizing some results here today. Five. I suggest that our positive duties to others will almost certainly require most of us to address easily preventable deaths of innocents before contributing to most other worthy causes, such as the arts, scenic improvements, or, dare I say it, higher education. Though I'm grateful that the Uhuru Foundation. Thus, absent special agent relative duties or our deepest projects and commitments requiring otherwise, perhaps we may permissibly give to such causes only after first fulfilling our positive duty to respond to the most urgent needs of others. Six, I point out how many in the developed world are extraordinarily rich by global standards, and how much well-off people spend on frivolous items in a world where millions go to bed hungry each night. on fancy cars, massive homes, sporting events, large-screen TVs, toys, appliances, clothes, fancy meals, luxury vacations, and so on. I'm guilty of all of these. I've observed that in 2009, individual Americans gave a total of $8.9 billion to international aid, while spending $380 billion, excuse me, on tobacco products, $435 billion on alcohol, more than $300 billion on soft drinks, candy, chips, and other snack foods, $2.6 trillion on eating out, and $2.7 trillion on entertainment. Thus, individual Americans would have had to contribute as much as they spent in 2009 on international aid for more than 720 years before they would have spent as much as they spent in 2009 alone on tobacco, alcohol, snack foods, entertainment, and eating out. I've known that in 2009, Americans could have increased their donation to aid groups by more than 104 times, from $8.9 billion to over $928 billion, merely by cutting their consumption of junk food, restaurant food, tobacco, and alcohol by 25%, and spending the money saved on aid groups. I noted that such a shift would not only have benefited the needy, would also have benefited the well-off, as presumably fewer would die from stroke, heart disease, lung cancer, car accidents, and other factors related to unhealthy eating, drinking, and smoking habits. I have pointed out numerous ways in which most people in affluent countries could make small changes in their lifestyles, which over the course of a year could add up to a significant amount. Sent to an effective aid group, such an amount could substantially improve the quality of life of some of the world's neediest members. Moreover, the lifestyle changes that I proposed were such that in a short time, most people probably wouldn't even notice the difference in their lives, like if they ordered a smaller coffee each day or started wearing no-name brands. Or where there wouldn't even be a difference in the quality of their lives, like if they were careful to buy whatever items they wanted on sale or at discount stores. Or where there would be a difference in their lives, but the difference would almost certainly be better for them, like if they moderately cut down on how much they smoked, drank alcohol, or dined out. In sum, I believe that we should adopt a pluralistic approach to normative issues, and that at such an approach, most of us should do much more than we do to aid the needy. We should do this for consequentialist reasons to make the world better, for virtuous reasons because that is the kind of person one should be, and for deontological reasons because aiding the needy is not merely an option, but a duty, and maybe every bit as strict as our duties to respect rights and act justly. Reflecting on points 1 through 8, I once wrote the following. I quote myself, sorry. The degree to which we are morally blameworthy for not aiding someone in need is partly a function of how dire the need is, and partly a function of how much it would cost us to do so, not only monetarily, but in terms of humanly valuable projects, relationships, responsibilities, and commitments. But surely, by such criteria, we are open to serious moral criticism when we basically ignore, as most of us do, the tragic plight of innocent people suffering from easily preventable causes. It is clear that each of us could do vastly more than we do to help the needy without making a dent in our affluent lifestyle. And I, for one, still quoting myself, have no doubt that when the necessary arguments have been adduced, they will support what most of us in our heart of hearts already believe, namely, that the extent to which we neglect the needy is a serious moral failing. End quote. To a large degree, I stand by most of the preceding claims. However, I now believe that matters are not as simple as I previously thought. And I have come grudgingly to have grave worries about certain assumptions that I have held for more than 3 decades. My hope is that all of us who share the same starting point about the importance of aiding the world's needy will take these worries seriously, and collectively determine the best response to them. Unfortunately, I now believe that much more work still needs to be done, both empirically and theoretically, to determine the true nature and extent of our obligations to the needy. Section 1.4, Singer's Pond example. 1972, Peter Singer presented the following case in his now classic article, Famine, Affluence, and Morality, and it's on your handout, though few people in this room will need to look at it. The pond example. If I'm walking past a shallow pond, and see a child drowning in it, I ought to wade in and pull out the child. This will mean getting my clothes muddy, but this is insignificant, while the death of the child would presumably be a very bad thing. It is, I believe, difficult to exaggerate the impact on global consciousness that Singer's Pond example has had. Since it was first introduced, countless people have concluded, based on that example, that they ought to aid the needy. Arguably, the roots of effective altruism can be traced to Singer's article, and even today, effective altruists often present versions of the pond example in support of their position. But does the pond example actually support effective altruism's view that in aiding the needy, we should act so as to most efficiently address the most important needs so as to produce the most good? I think not. What the pond example seems to establish, I emphasize seems, is that if we can directly help someone need at little cost to ourselves, we should do so. But that position is compatible with a number of approaches to aiding the needy, including my own favored pluralistic approach. Consider a variation of the pond example, which is on your handout, the pond and arm example. I'm walking by a pond where a child is drowning. Unfortunately, the only way to save the child is cut off the arm of an innocent passerby and extend it to the drowning child. The passerby refuses to give me permission to cut off his arm, even though he will be fine, but for the loss of his arm. What should I do? This example raises a host of much debated questions regarding acts versus omissions, harming versus not helping, deontology versus utilitarianism, and so on. It's not my intent to rehash those debates here. Instead, I will simply note that most people who are not strict utilitarians will think that it would be wrong to save the child in the way described. My case suggests two lessons. First, non-utilitarians attracted to effective altruism will want to hold that the aim of producing the most good must be tempered by competing moral considerations. This opens the door for my pluralistic approach to understand the nature and extent of our obligations to the needy. Second, the tempting initial conclusion drawn from Singer's example, that if we can help someone in need at little cost to ourselves, we should do so, was much too quick. In my example, I can help someone in need at little cost to myself. Still, I would have to impose costs on someone else in a way that may make it impermissible for me to aid the needy, even if the outcome in which I aid the needy is better than the one in which I don't. Importantly, Singer anticipates such worries. In Famine, Affluence, and Morality, he presents a strong and a weak principle, both of which are on your handout, as possibly bearing on our obligations towards the needy. The strong principle, which Singer himself actually favors, is preventing bad without comparable moral loss. If it's in our power to prevent something very bad from happening, without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral significance, we ought morally to do it. The weak principle, which the pond example is offered as an application of, is preventing bad without moral loss. If it's in our power to prevent something very bad from happening, without thereby sacrificing anything morally significant, we ought morally to do it. Clearly, Singer's weak principle can accommodate most people's intuitions about my pond case, since in that case, saving the child's life would require sacrificing something morally significant. By contrast, in Singer's original pond case, there was just me and the child in the pond. And there's no issue about my imposing costs on others, violating anyone's rights, or in any other way acting wrongly if I choose to save the child's life. What about Singer's strong principle? That depends, of course, on what counts as a comparable moral loss. Singer glosses that notion as follows, I quote, By without sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, I mean without causing anything else comparably bad to happen, or doing something that is wrong in itself, or failing to promote some moral good comparable in significance to some bad thing that we can prevent. Thus, if, as many believe, cutting off someone's arm would be wrong, even for the sake of saving another's life, then even seeing a strong principle could capture most people's intuitions about my pond case. We see then that Singer's pond example was never intended to support a simple utilitarian version of effective altruism. It was merely offered in support of the view that we should prevent bad whenever that would involve no sacrifice of moral significance. But does the pond example support a non-utilitarian version of effective altruism? To the effect that aiding the needy should be guided by the principle of doing the most good we can, except in cases where doing so would involve acting wrongly, harming someone, violating rights, etc. This is, to my mind, a more plausible version of effective altruism. Even so, it's hard to see how the pond example supports such a view, though it is compatible with it. More importantly, depending on how broadly one construes the restrictions on doing the most good, it seems that either the position is still problematic, or that it has strayed pretty far from the spirit of effective altruism as most people now espouse it. To see this, let us consider another example, which is on your handout. The pond, the Rolex, and the sudden epiphany. Nick is not rich, at least by U.S. standards, but he leads a comfortable U.S. middle-class existence. His only real luxury item is a non-waterproof Rolex watch given to him by a favorite uncle. Because of the watch's value, it has an elaborate safety clasp that is difficult to undo. One day, as Nick is walking to work, he passes a pond where a child is drowning. The only way for Nick to save the child is to immediately dive into the water. Nick's first thought is that he must dive in and save the child. Nick's second thought is that if he does so, his Rolex will be ruined. But they won't have time to take it off and still save the child. Nick's third thought is that as much as he loves his watch, that is insignificant in comparison with the child's life. So Nick decides to dive in and save the child. However, just as Nick is about to do so, he has an epiphany. He realizes that he could sell his Rolex for $5,000 and donate the proceeds to an effective aid group, which would use the money to save three children who are no less deserving than the drowning child. Telling himself that the drowning child's flailing arms, desperate cries for help, and gasps for air are simply making his imminent death more salient than the deaths of the three children who would be saved by the effective aid group, Nick resolves to preserve and sell his Rolex, and to give the proceeds to an effective charity. Seeing no point in just standing by the pond and watching the child drown, Nick calls 911, reports the drowning child's location, and then continues on to work. Later that week, Nick sells his watch, donates the proceeds to an effective aid group, and sometime later, three innocent children on the other side of the world are saved due to Nick's actions. What should we say about this example? First, I'll indicate my response. I'm the speaker, I get to do that. Then I'll say a bit more in defense of my response and consider some of my view's broader implications. I recognize that by acting as he did, Nick saved three lives instead of just one. Nevertheless, I feel there must be something wrong with Nick for him to be able to act as he did. Moreover, I believe that he probably acted wrongly, even though his motive was the laudable one of wanting to save three lives instead of one. Several factors are influencing my judgment about this case. First, to borrow a famous expression from the philosopher Bernard Williams, I think that Nick had one thought too many in his deliberations about what to do. His initial thought was the correct one, that he must dive in and save the child. I don't fault Nick for having a second thought, that doing so would ruin his watch. But then he should immediately think, as he did, that ruining his Rolex is of no significance in comparison with a child's life. And that thought should have been his final thought on the matter. That is, if Nick were a decent person, his deliberation should have come to a halt at that point. There should have been no further thinking that led to his epiphany, and he should have simply dived in and saved the child. Or so I believe, anyway. My view about Nick is related to my view about virtues and the importance of being virtuous. Aristotle famously claimed that virtue is a disposition acquired by habit. This meant that one becomes virtuous by repeatedly doing what a virtuous person does. Eventually, one acquires the habit of acting virtuously, meaning that one will be automatically disposed to do the virtuous thing whenever an appropriate occasion for exercising the virtue presents itself. The point is that psychological dispositions cannot be turned on and off like a spigot, nor are they easily fine-tuned. So, for example, if one truly has the virtue of faithfulness, one doesn't even consider the possible pros and cons of cheating on one's spouse when an opportunity to do so presents itself. One simply acts faithfully, where others lacking that virtue would respond differently. Of course, a virtuous person hasn't lost her capacity for rational reflection. There may be some circumstances where reasons to not act virtuously are so evident and compelling that even a virtuous person may determine that on that occasion they ought not to do what they are automatically disposed to do. However, I believe that a person of great virtue won't even entertain certain thoughts to which a less virtuous person might readily succumb. The point, of course, is that I believe that the virtues of sympathy, caring, kindness, compassion, and generosity should lead Nick to immediately respond to the drowning child's plight. This is why I claimed that Nick had one thought too many, and that there must be something wrong with him. For Nick to have responded as he did, he would have had to lack the virtues of sympathy, caring, kindness, compassion, and generosity. Thinking about my example prompts another response as well. We commonly think of obligations to the needy as part of a general agent neutral duty of beneficence. On reflection, however, I believe that there can be agent relative duties of beneficence between strangers. Prior to seeing the child in the pond, Nick has a general duty to aid the needy. But when Nick finds himself face to face with a drowning child, I believe that a new agent relative duty arises that requires Nick to save the child. Moreover, I believe that that duty takes precedent over Nick's general duty to aid the needy in the same way that Nick's agent relative duties to his family can take priority over his general duty to aid the needy. This is why I claim that there would not only be something wrong with Nick, but that there would also be something wrong with what Nick did. Finally, let me say a bit more about the relevance of the face-to-face nature of Nick's situation. First, it isn't important that Nick literally be face-to-face with the drowning child, or for Nick to have an agent relative duty to save the child. Nick would have an equally strong duty if the drowning child happened to be facing away from him. Second, I readily accept the view that someone who lives on the other side of the world is no less valuable morally than someone who's right next to me. That's not the issue here. Nevertheless, some philosophers claim that the quintessential ethical moment arises when two human beings directly confront each other, and each recognizes that the other is, in a fundamentally important respect, a subject just like oneself. On their view, this crucial ethical moment involves mutual recognition between two subjects of consciousness, and it serves as the basis for the moral enterprise, which requires us to recognize and respect the interests and rights of others who are, in the most important respects, just like
us.
I don't want to exaggerate the role that such personal interactions play in grounding morality. Still, I do believe that there's something deeply important for morality about personal one-on-one interactions, where one is confronted in a stark and undeniable form with the reality, fragility, mortality, and humanity of another. It is, I believe, largely in those moments where one's own character and humanity are formed and revealed. If you find yourself in one-on-one contact with another whose very survival at that crucial moment depends on you, and you could easily help them at no significant cost to yourself or others, then I believe that any decent human being would and should help that person. We do have a general agent neutral duty to help others in need, and other things duty, that duty, directs us to help more people rather than fewer people in need. However, that general duty does not, I believe, trump the other moral considerations that arise in the case that Nick is facing. This discussion bears on two related issues. First, when climbers are stranded on a mountain, miners are entrapped under, are entombed underground, or spelunkers, for a friend of mine in the audience, or sailors are lost at sea, the entire world may get caught up in their plight, and seemingly no expense is spared to save them. Similarly, when a reactor melts down, a tsunami hits, or an earthquake strikes, food, supplies, equipment, and highly trained emergency crews will fly in from around the world to assist. From the standpoint of effective altruism, such efforts are often deeply misguided. And I confess, a big part of me shares that view. When I think of all the resources spent on saving a single white toddler, some of you will recall the name if you're old enough, baby Jessica, trapped at the bottom of a well, it seems tragically wasteful given all the black, brown, and yellow toddlers that could have been saved if those same resources had instead been spent on extremely cost-effective oral rehydration salts, vitamin A capsules, antibiotics, vaccines, bed nets, and food packets to combat diarrhea, weakened immune systems, pneumonia, measles, whooping cough, diphtheria, tetanus, polio, malaria, chronic starvation, and malnourishment. Still, there is ultimately something heroic, uplifting, and noble about dramatic rescues. Pulling someone from the rubble of a collapsed building many days after an earthquake powerfully reminds us of the extraordinary value of each life. Kant famously claimed that each life has infinite value, and while that is surely too strong, our no-cost-is-too-high approach to dramatic rescues gives voice to something deeply attractive about Kant's position. There's also something inspiring and valuable about the way in which otherwise deeply divided nations come together to aid natural disaster victims. Dramatic rescues remind us of our common humanity and prompt us to act in light of that humanity. Clearly, they are not cost-effective. Yet other important values would be lost if we stopped engaging in such rescues. Williams famously noted that people who always acted to promote the most good would need to abandon many valuable features of human life, such as love, friendship, loyalty, honesty, reliability, and trustworthiness. Similarly, I believe that overall our lives would be sadder, bleaker, colder, less valuable, and less praiseworthy if we lacked the virtues and spark of humanity that give rise to dramatic rescues despite their inefficiency. So once again, I suggest that in lieu of the simple monistic aim of doing as much good as we can, we need a more nuanced, pluralistic view that gives due weight to our full normative reality regarding how to respond to those in need. Second, Some effective altruists believe that the goal of doing as much good as possible has implications not merely for which charities one should support, but also for how one should support the needy. For example, some effective altruists would advise people with lucrative jobs to spend more time at work and to donate the extra money to effective aid groups rather than to spend those extra hours doing hands-on charity work, such as serving in a soup kitchen or building homes for Habitat for Humanity. Likewise, they would advise those who could to hold high-paying jobs and donate portions of their salaries to effective aid groups rather than to be aid workers. And they might also advise an investment banker serving wealthy clients to cut corners in certain ways rather than serve one's clients honestly. If one could do so without being caught, and doing so would enable one to earn and donate much more money to effective aid groups. Now, I readily grant that in many cases, acting in such ways would most benefit the needy and would also bring about the best outcome. Thus, the general duty of beneficence and reasons to promote utility would support such actions. Still, I believe there's much more to being a decent person than working a high-paying job and supporting effective aid groups, even if one's motivation is the noble one of helping others. Arguably, there's much to be said for directly and courageously confronting others in need, one-on-one, and appropriately responding to their plight, and for living a life of great virtue and integrity where one has earned a good name and the respect that comes with it. I grant that a shady but highly paid investment banker who contributes vast sums to effective aid groups may do much more good than an on-the-ground aid worker, and that she may take advantage of her clients for moral reasons and with the best of intentions. Moreover, she will have sacrificed her good name for others less fortunate, and certainly there is something praiseworthy about that. Still, by assumption, she will have betrayed, for the sake of the greater good, a host of virtues in her day-to-day dealings with others who are counting on her to act on their behalf. Among the many virtues she will have abandoned are the virtues of honesty, trustworthiness, dependability, reliability, and integrity. To my mind, such a life may produce much good, but it is not a good life. And I would not want anyone dear to me to lead such a life. The point here is not to settle the issue of what we should do, all things considered, to help the needy, but to stress that we need to consider the full range of factors relevant to leading the moral life. Effective altruism's do the most good approach reflects one very important factor that needs to be considered, but is not, I submit, the only one. Let me conclude this section by returning to the upshot of Singer's original pond example. Recall that Singer originally presented his pond example as an application of the weak principle, preventing bad without moral loss. It's on your handout. If it's in our power to prevent something very bad from happening without thereby sacrificing anything morally significant, we ought morally to do it. Surely this position is compatible with everything I have said in this section. If, for example, one believes that one should save the drowning child, in my case of the pond, the Rolex, and the sudden epiphany, one can point to the moral significance of the child's life, as well as other morally relevant factors that would also need to be sacrificed in support of the view that one needn't act as effective altruism dictates. Similarly, for cases involving dramatic rescues, the question of whether checkbook charity is enough or more personal involvement is desirable, and the issue of whether one's choice of jobs and the action one performs doing those jobs should be mainly guided by the goal of maximizing one's donations to effective aid groups. In all these cases, Singer's preventing bad without moral loss would not entail the effective altruist recommendations, since many factors of moral significance would have to be sacrificed to do the most good on behalf of the needy. Again, his view would be compatible with those views, but it doesn't entail those views. As for Singer's preferred stronger principle, preventing bad without comparable moral loss, that principle's judgments regarding my cases will depend on what counts as comparable moral loss, which, as we saw, Singer glossed as without causing anything else comparably bad to happen or doing something that is wrong in itself or failing to promote some moral good comparable in significance to some bad thing that we can prevent. Arguably, there's an agent relative duty to aid someone we are in a special position to help. So that in a case like the pond, the Rolex, and the sudden epiphany, it would be wrong not to save the child, even though we could do more good by letting her drown. Likewise, it's also arguable that failing to act virtuously, failing to respond to the needs of another that one is confronting one-on-one, failing to act with integrity or uphold one's good name, failing to get directly involved in aiding the needy, and so on, are taken individually or collectively of comparable moral significance to doing more good rather than less. This reflects the pluralistic perspective that many factors have great moral significance besides promoting the most good. To be sure, effective altruists may argue that the cases where competing moral factors are comparable in moral significance with saving more lives are far fewer than this discussion may seem to suggest. But such a claim will be much less plausible when one moves from cases of saving lives to the more general case of minimizing dollies. This is a substantive matter that my discussion hasn't settled one way or the other. But I hope to have said enough to show that we need to be sensitive to a wide range of morally relevant factors in determining the nature and extent of our obligations to the needy. Section 1.5, conclusion. Let me end with a summary of today's talk and a brief look ahead. In this talk, I presented Singer's famous pond example, which has had a profound effect on many people's thinking about our obligations to the needy, and which helped to give rise to the effective altruism movement. A movement that holds that when aiding the needy, one ought to act in the most effective manner to support the most effective aid groups that are doing the most important work. Practically, many effective altruists have advocated minimizing dollies by supporting aid groups which help those people in the world's poorest countries facing premature death or severely debilitating conditions as a result of poverty, famine, war, tyranny, ignorance, or disease. While I have long shared Singer's and effective altruism's goal of wanting to aid the needy, I believe that we need to reject any narrow, single-minded approach to thinking about the problem in favor of a broader, pluralistic approach. Summarizing positions defended elsewhere, I claim that there are powerful consequentialist, virtue, and deontological-based reasons to aid the needy. I also know that while Singer's pond example is compatible with effective altruism, it is also fully compatible with my own pluralistic approach. One lesson that Singer's pond example seems to imply is that if I can substantially help someone in need at little cost to myself, I should do so. But I showed that that conclusion is much too quick. Among other things, it ignores the possible impact of my actions on others besides me and the intended beneficiary of my action. And this point we will return to in spades in the following two lectures. This point, of which Singer was well aware, leads us to recognize that many considerations may be relevant to the morality of aiding the needy. This includes whether I may be wrongly harming others or violating people's rights in aiding the needy. The virtues of sympathy, caring, kindness, compassion, and generosity may also be relevant. So too, I claimed, is a special agent relative duty to aid someone in need that arises when one comes directly into contact with such a person. I suggested that there's something deeply important for morality about personal one-on-one interactions where one is starkly confronted with the reality, fragility, mortality, and humanity of another. It is largely in those moments, I claimed, where one's own character and humanity are formed and revealed. I discussed cases of dramatic rescues and global responses to large-scale disasters. I contended that while there's something to be said for the effective altruist view that such efforts are often terribly wasteful, There's also something uplifting and noble about such efforts. They remind us of our common humanity, and they prompt fractious groups to join together and act in light of that common humanity. Echoing Williams, I suggested that, certainly didn't improve, overall human life would be sadder, bleaker, colder, less valuable, and less praiseworthy if we lacked the virtues and spark of humanity that lead us to respond as we do to such events. Similarly, I challenged the view of some effective altruists concerning what jobs we should take, how we should perform those jobs, and why, for many, it's just a waste of time to be personally involved in helping the needy. In opposition to this perspective, I claim that there's much to be said for engaging in a morally praiseworthy life, where one has the courage to directly confront others in need and to appropriately respond to their plight. And also much to be said for living a life of great virtue and integrity. Someone who has abandoned the virtues of honesty, trustworthy, dependability, reliability, and integrity for the sake of aiding the needy may produce much good, but to my mind, hers will not be a good life. Summing up, I have not tried to settle the question of what we should do, all things considered, to aid the needy. However, so far, my discussion has suggested that by itself, Singer's example doesn't take us very far in answering that question. I have argued that we need to be responsive to the full range of moral factors that have a bearing on that issue, including all of the factors that are relevant to leading a morally praiseworthy life. The act so as to do the most good approach of effective altruism reflects one very important factor that needs to be considered, but is not, I have argued, the only one. In the second and third lectures, I will consider a number of disanalogies between saving a drowning child and giving to aid groups, and raise some worries about possible negative impacts of aiding the needy. I will argue that these disanalogies and worries have important normative significance, making the case for contributing to aid groups much more problematic than the case for saving Singer's drowning child. I will also discuss the possibility that aiding the needy may give rise to an each-we dilemma involving a deep conflict between what is individually rational or moral and what is collectively rational or moral. Unfortunately, it's possible that if each of us does what each of us has most reason to do morally in aiding the needy, we together will bring about an outcome which is worse, morally, in terms of its overall impact on the global needy, or so I shall suggest in the final lecture. Thank you very much for your attention.